Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. How do we combat climate change? It can seem overwhelming at times, but ultimately humans will have to face major changes in how we heat and cool our homes, major changes to electrify our economy and transportation systems, and major changes in how we generate that electricity to fuel our economy. But there are other ways we can regenerate and reduce our carbon footprints. Working in combination, my guest says we can end the climate crisis in a generation. Paul Hawken is a leading environmentalist, eco-entrepreneur, and author. His previous book, Drawdown, was a major bestseller. And his latest book, Regeneration, addresses over 50 ways we can reduce the carbon emissions directly or indirectly. They range from reforestation to seaforestation to absorb carbon, to vermiculture, using worms to rebuild depleted soils, or the use of azolla ferns and biochar for animal feed, looking at agricultural innovations to both increase production and reduce emissions, innovative energy storage systems for that increase in wind and solar production, and also how industries must adapt to meet the challenges ahead. Paul Hawken's new book is titled Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. It's published by Penguin. Paul Hawken, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you so much, Rich.
Yeah, this book was a much-needed tonic for me as it explores a lot of ways that we can sequester carbon in addition to the very difficult decisions that countries and multilateral organizations are going to have to eventually take to reduce carbon emissions. But there's a lot that seems relatively easy to do, at least with a will. Can we reverse our climate trends in a generation, as your subtitle of the book suggests?
We can't reverse it in a generation. What we can do in a generation is get on the right road at the right rate, at the right pace, and so forth, in terms of our activity, a rate that will take us to where we want to go in 2030, 2040, 2050. That we can do. And that's what I mean about ending the crisis. The crisis now isn't not only that global warming exists, but that we're going backwards. In other words, we're making it worse every year. We're not even neutral now, much less trying to address it. So I define that's what ending the climate crisis in one generation. So we start to feel 10, 15 years like we're on it. We get it. We're working together, you know, in where we can, you know, all over the world in a way that's substantive and that will take us to where we need to be by 2040, 2050. Yeah.
But that's the rub right there, is that even though countries will sort of agree to do things, the actual practice of it hasn't seemed to ever work out.
Well, wonder why. Let's deconstruct that one. Why are 98% of the world, people in the world, disengaged? It's interesting. It's the greatest crisis that humanity has ever faced, and I would dare say ever will face, probably, hopefully. And over 98% of people are not doing anything at all, even if they are sympathetic, empathetic, and understand the cause and respect the science. They're still not doing anything. And so that is really, really fascinating to me as a journalist, as a writer. And I address it in the book and I talk about it, you know, which is like, and you could point your finger at them, you could blame them, you could say, tsk, tsk, you know, I don't. I think what it's about is language and communication. And the way we've communicated a warming world to people guarantees that they'll be disengaged, because it happened originally with climate science. It goes back 45, 50 years, and it's future existential threat, okay? And this is what we face, a threat, and that's fear and threat, okay? And then that got picked up by journalists, but also activists. And the activists picked it up as, there are people responsible for this, you know? I mean, oil companies and Exxon and this and that and so forth, you know? And so that is shame, blame, and then guilt, you know? So you have shame, blame, guilt, and fear, and threat. Okay, that's five really interesting words right there. And then on top of that, then people said, well, we have to combat it and fight it and tackle it, you know, which are verbs, not goals, by the way. No verb is a goal. And then you have this, well, what does that mean, fighting it, you know? And because there's no it there. Where's the it? You can't find right. The it. It doesn't exist.
I also think it's a sense of privation, of scarcity, of mm-hmm. you know, giving up things, as opposed to changing how you do things.
Exactly. Evolving, changing, growing, learning. I mean, and those are very fighting, tackling, combating are very male metaphors or male verbs. They come from war and sports, and those are othering language. So we othered it. We put it out there somewhere, wherever there is. And but othering is, you know, the Me Too movement is othering, and racism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. We have all these different ways of othering people, and now we've othered the world itself, the living world, this beautiful system we call Earth, and we've othered it as if there was an it out there that is going wrong, we have to fix. That language, you know, then fear, shame, blame, guilt, you know, I'll mix all that together and say, hey, do something. It's like, you know, I mean, no wonder people are disengaged, you know, when they read, hear about it in that way. And then you say, well, there's climate deniers, you know, who, you know, but there's very few of them left. But even they, though, you know, compared to people who know about it and don't do anything from the Earth's point of view, there's no difference at all between somebody who's sympathetic and somebody who's apathetic and somebody who's basically antagonistic. From the Earth's point of view, if they don't do anything, same person.
In the book, you provide six frameworks for the ways we can begin to reverse these climate trends. And they involve equity, reduction, protection, and sequestering, influence, and support.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the first one first, equity. One of the big issues as we look at deforestation, you're looking at peatlands that are being converted to agricultural use, is the fact that you have people in the developing world that see this as the best and easiest way to get ahead, to provide for themselves. How do we begin to change that equity argument so they have, they feel, and we as end consumers are helping them find other ways other than deforestation and those sorts of things?
Well, we have to be a little bit careful about the quote-unquote people.
Yes.
I mean, there's no they there. When we talk about deforestation in Amazon, we're talking about JBS, the biggest meat company in the world, okay? and cahoots with Bolsonaro, you know, and they say, oh, we just buy soybeans. Well, yeah, they do. Really cheap soybeans grown on what used to be forests, you know? And so the people who are burning the forest, you know, to grow the soybeans, you know, JBS says, oh, we don't have anything to do with that. Yes, they do. They buy them. And the same thing holds true with the Kalimantan and Borneo and Indonesia and the palm oil plantations and so forth. You know, these were all created by multi-billionaires in Indonesia, not by the people, not by the natives, not by the indigenous people, not by the people who live there. These were done by, and yes, people work there now, you know, and have jobs, you know, but the point being is that the idea didn't come from people living on the land. It came from people who lived in Jakarta and in their private jets and in their, you know, whatever. And that's what the source of that. So we have to be really careful that people are just, you know, innocently making a livelihood, and how are we going to stop them from doing that? And we're talking about, you know, in Amazon, you know, land is the Ashuar land. Ashuar have been there for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. You know, we're living very well and taking incredibly impeccable care of the land, the forest, the creatures, the waters, and so forth, you know. And so those are the people we should be listening to and hoping and trying to protect, not basically people who are taking life. And that goes back to really the source of all, in all economic sectors, is supply chains that, whether they're services or products, that basically extract life. This is an extractive economy. It's taking life. And when you take life, it's called degeneration. That's what it is. And so when you degenerate life and so forth, you have less of it. And you turn it into capital, into money. What do people do with money? They concentrate it and focus it. So the top 10% of income earners in the world, 56% of global emissions, you know. The other 90% of the other 44%, you know. And so the fact is, you know, and you look at the news cycle and what's going on right now, especially this year, but prior to this as well, is you can see that this road that we're on, it's a degenerative road without exception, doesn't go much further. In other words, you can kind of see the end of that road. Why do you keep going down? Why are we going to keep going down that road? Really? I don't think so, because it spells the end. And so what regeneration is about is asking the question and positing the possibility of like a 180, which is, instead of creating an economy that creates lots of capital but steals the future from our children and from their children and their children's children's children to an economy and a business and GDP and commerce, ways of doing things that actually heal the future. And everything in life out there creates more life. Life creates the conditions for more life. This is a fundamental principle. That's why there's so much life on Earth, okay, over hundreds of millions of years. And so there's no reason we can't have institutions and ways of living to do the same. We do know how to do that right now. There's a burgeoning regeneration movement all over the planet.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that regeneration movement. I mean, the very idea is that, you know, the best way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is don't put them in the atmosphere in the first place. And that means sequestering. It means reducing the amount that you are putting in the air and using the Earth's natural processes basically to capture it and keep it on Earth.
Yeah, it's what the Earth wants to do. Earth is a carbon collector. And we hear about the, like, carbon pollution and carbon dioxide going up there. It's not a pollutant at all. It's food for life. It's what all living plant forms, you know, eat on a daily basis and turn into oxygen and sugar, you know, carbohydrates and cellulose and so forth. So we have to see carbon not as the enemy, you know, but as a gift, as an ally, as, you know, the basis of life. And one of the solutions of the six you named is protect. And what does that mean? And I don't mean it in the normal sense of conservation, for sure. It includes that, and that's great. But on the earthly systems, terrestrial systems, not oceans, there's 3,300 gigatons, 3,300 billion tons of sea carbon. That's four times as much carbon than is in the atmosphere. And so if we look at your backyard, look at forests, look at, you know, regenerative ag versus industrial ag, you look at different practices. If we can increase the amount of carbon in terrestrial systems, in our wetlands, in our coastal mangroves, et cetera, by 9% by 2050, we will have sequestered every bit of carbon dioxide emitted since 1800. And so now there's more carbon we're emitting from between now and 2050, and that would require another 4 or 5%. But the point being is, if you look at any basically, you know, non-virginal, degraded land, farmland, forest land, and so forth, your backyard, and you say, can I increase this by 9%? Easy, easy peasy. And we just have to want to do it, and we know how to do it, that's for sure. And so that's just one way of looking at where we are that is optimistic. There's many, many, many more things that we can do. And the website, it has the biggest listing network of climate solutions in the world and how to do them and all the connections to the organizations, people, and all over who are doing it and know how to do it and want support, want help, want to engage with you and so forth. So we have an amazing community on Earth of human beings who understand the problem, but don't just understand it and watch it on Netflix, but actually are out there in the world doing something about it. And I would say, knowing those people, not all of them, just some of them, but knowing them, they're having a whole lot more fun than most people I know.
My guest today is Paul Hawken, an environmentalist and author. His new book is titled Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. It's published by Penguin. And in it, you go through ways in which we can do it in our oceans and water, our food supply, land usage, all sorts of ways. I'd like to spend some time on issues that apply particularly to our part of the country, things like land issues. You know, you look at the way we do agriculture, things like regenerative agriculture, animal integration. I think to most farmers, this sounds pretty crazy, but you interview farmers that are using animal integration. What is animal integration?
Well, it's the way nature has always farmed. Nature never farms without an animal. So whether it's the Buffalo Commons or the Serengeti or whether it's forests or whether it's mangroves or wetlands or you name it, there's always animals there, right? And the way to make a rich, let's talk about soil now, you know, a rich environment for plants, if they're annuals in the case of our crops or perennials, is you need that interaction with animals. And what we did here in this country, especially after the war, World War II, is that we put the animals someplace else, and we took them off the land, and we devoted the land to basically row crops, mostly corn and soy, but also, you know, other grain crops, wheat, etc. And the land deteriorated, no question about it. And it didn't matter at that time because we were deploying chemical fertilizers very, very heavily after the war. And, you know, I mean, they work in the sense of a plant gets greener, faster, bigger with, you know, nitrogen supplied chemically than it does from soils that have been somewhat degraded by tillage and other practices. And so that was a no-brainer for farmers to employ chemical fertilizer. But if you actually step back and look at it, what industrial ag was doing was putting on basically macronutrients, you know, nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus, in an assimilable, bioavailable form to the plant roots right away. And the plant roots didn't have to go down very far to get it because it was being top dressed. And so the plants did grow, and they were more productive, and they were also weaker, and they weren't strong. They weren't as healthy as plants that have deep tap roots and into healthy soil. And they were subject to insect infestation, and then you have pesticides, and then to weed competition and weeds. As soil degrades, by the way, you get different levels of weeds. Weeds are there. There's a beautiful book by Joseph Kochenauer published by the University of Oklahoma Press, okay, called Weeds, you know. And what he pointed out is you can tell the quality or the lack of quality or what's missing in the soil by the weeds that want to grow there. Is it Acadian thistle? Is it pigweed? Is it this and so forth? Those weeds are telling you, and they're trying to heal the soil. They're not like anthropogenically thinking about it. It's just what happens to the soil. And so you got more weeds, and then you got herbicides. Then you have herbicides, pesticides, artificial fertilizers, and then you have runoff. And the runoff basically kills life, goes into the down the Mississippi, causes the dead zone, you know, a huge dead zone. There's dead zones all over the world.
Yeah.
For nitrogen runoff.
Yeah. Any major river will have them. Yeah.
Yeah. And that what it did to soil basically was change it to dirt. And Oklahoma, you know, in Oklahoma, it's stated, you know, for every pound of wheat you get from Oklahoma, you get 3 pounds of soil eroded, gone, washed away forever. And so we know all this. It's regenerative agriculture is really like just, it's about soil health, you know. Instead of weeds, you put in cover crops. You keep the land covered. You don't let the sun touch the soil because that dries it out. You feed the soil with cover crops. You feed it by a more complex rotation of crops, not just soy corn, soy corn, soy corn. What happens is as you feed the soil and you protect the soil, you get more life in the soil. And that's C, that's carbon, that's sequestration. But more importantly is that carbon, all those life forms, the protozoa, the viruses, the bacteria, so they are assimilating and making bioavailable minerals to the plants. And so you're getting plants that are much healthier, more robust, more resistant to infestation, and more healthy for animals or people, depending on what's eating that food. And the other thing that happens is, you know, down, it's kind of a community down there, but it's like so wild. I mean, there's trillions, you know, just in a, like a little 10 square feet, there's trillions and trillions and trillions of organisms down there, which we don't fully understand. But what we do know is that they're all eating each other. and they produce the glomulin, these long carbon chains, you know, sticky kind of stuff, you know, and it makes the soil friable. It makes it permeable. It makes it crumbly instead of hard pan and tough and, you know, where the water just runs off. And so you're seeing in farmers who go to regenerative agriculture over not too long a time and who integrate animals into their agricultural practices, which is you have a cover crop. Now you want to drill. Well, you bring in the cattle, then they munch it down, and then you drill your wheat or corn or soy, whatever you're growing, and so forth. But what you're seeing is those lands are capable of taking 10, 20, 30 times much water before there's runoff. And they don't take the soil away because of the plants are there, the cover crops. They slow the water down. And so now the soil is a reservoir, you know, not a sidewalk. I mean, it's not hard pan. And the reservoir means the farmer has more resilience when droughts, and or like the derecho that happened in Iowa last year, you know, they're resistant to too much rain too soon, okay? That causes erosion and washes their topsoil away. So regenerative agriculture is booming. Nestle, the biggest food company in the world, announced last week that they're going to generation regeneration. That is their slogan, and they're converting, or they're working with the farmers, I should say. There's a very important distinction to convert all 1 million farms that are in their supply chain to regenerative agriculture in the world.
Yeah.
So this isn't like kind of out there where somebody in, you know, somewhere has got this, you know, crazy idea about farming. This is the farming of the future because it works better. There's less inputs, more profit for the farmer, less poison, or none at all, safer environment for his or her family, better water infiltration. I mean, feeds the pollinators, which we're running out of. I mean, it's just the list, check, 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 check. You know,
that's right.
This is how we're going to farm in the future.
I want to talk about another idea. You have a whole section on food, and it starts with the wasting nothing and the localization of food. And something that, again, this is an idea that you write about from Oklahoma, milpa gardens. What is a milpa garden?
Yeah, I'm glad you caught that one. That's the Cannon family down in Oklahoma, Tom and Reagan, his daughter. Milpa is what, you know, corn, bean, and squash, that kind of thing, the Native American, the Three Sisters is called.
Right.
And, you know, and that's the way it was invented in Mesoamerica years and years ago, milpa gardens. And, you know, the beans fix nitrogen in the soil, and, you know, there's this beautiful relationship between those three plants. And so there's a guy named Keith Burns, and he's an agronomist in Nebraska. And he has a milpa garden seed mix. Actually, it has more than three. It's got vegetables and beans and herbs and fruit, strawberries and things. And what farmers do is they pack their grain drill with this milpa garden, and they crisscross an acre of land, okay, squash and broccoli and leafy greens, you know, sunflowers, tomatoes, radishes, okra, whatever, watermelon.
Yeah.
And then they open up these one-acre plots because the food, we talk about food apartheid, you know, in the inner cities, like you can't get fresh vegetables. Guess where else you can't get fresh vegetables?
Rural areas, yeah.
Exactly. The stores are gone. The sources of vegetables are gone. The towns are too small, you know, to bring in all that stuff. And so what Keith is doing is giving away the seeds for an acre if you allow people and, you know, who... Boy Scouts or, you know, people who are lower income or who need it, you know, the food banks and so forth, to go in and take it. It's like a discovery. It's like people love it. They go in with their baskets and turn under a leaf and there's a cantaloupe, you know, and they can take whatever they want.
Yeah, no, it's really a great idea because you plant them so densely that it chokes out any weeds.
And, yeah, exactly.
And it's just all this cross
pollination. And what Tom Cannon's doing in Oklahoma, he's planting a whole bunch of them, you know, not an acre, 20, 30 acres a year. And one of the things they learned, which is so interesting, because I grew up on a farm and we canned food and in the basement, that was the whole larder, you know, it was red and blue and, you know,
right.
Beans and green and orange and yellow and jams and everything. And he found out, and he and his daughter Reagan found out, the people in the country had forgotten how to preserve food, you know, the can.
Yes.
And so now they're teaching farmers of all things how to prepare and preserve fresh food, you know. They're coming from the milpas, you know, pickle them, how to can them, how to cook, you know, all this sort of stuff. And so there's a kind of that's regeneration. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I mean, that is another aspect of regeneration. I'm sure they don't use the word. Who needs it?
Yeah.
They're doing it. And
right.
That's what's the most important thing.
In our last couple of minutes, I want to talk about cities. You have a whole section on cities, the use of urban farming, carbon architecture. But I want to, there's also about the 15-minute city, the idea that you're never 15 minutes away and you don't have to go all over the city to get things done. But, you know, I read this and, you know, urban mobility, using other things other than your car to get around. And I think for, you know, cities like here in the Midwest, our whole city is model is built on the automobile. How do you shift that?
Yeah, exactly.
How do you shift that?
Yeah, no. Yeah, suburbs and exurbs are like built by General Motors, you know.
Right.
I mean, designed.
Well, even the city itself is built on the idea of a car, not a streetcar that's going to take you places or you walk to the corner and catch public transit. It's just about the car.
It totally is. And we gave up the city to the car. 40% of the land in L.A. is devoted to the car. 40%?
Yeah.
Come on. Parking, garages, streets. Okay. So that's changing. And so older cities like Paris are doing the 15-minute city and Barcelona and so forth. So they're already dense, you know, from the past. And so they can do it more easily. What's happening to cities that aren't doing that is they're infilling to create density, to create the downtown or part a more lively, more populated, more of a place you want to be at night or in, during the day as well. And they're closing off streets, and they're closing them off, and making them esplanades, making them a place for people, for restaurants, for whoever, you know, to sit and play chess or whatever, and bring people out of their apartments or their homes and onto the street. And the way you make a street really safe is to have lots of people on it. That's a safe street. Unsafe streets are when you walk on the street at night and there's no one there, you can hear your own footsteps, and no one feels safe in that situation, right? And so bringing conviviality to the 15-minute city, urban mobility, so that you can get around on carless streets, you know, these micro-mobility is really the right term for that. You know, we're seeing them more and more. And the carbon architecture is really regenerative building, which is that buildings are 40% of our emissions. Our carbon emissions come from buildings and their operating emissions, and then all the emissions caused by the materials that go into building our buildings. And you're seeing some of the finest architects in the world, CERA, S-E-R-A, here on the West Coast, build low-income housing. There was affordable housing entirely out of basically mass timber. There's no steel. There's very little concrete. And they're affordable. And they actually, the emissions from the construction are actually negative. That is, they sequester carbon instead of emit them. This is happening right now. We know how to do this stuff, and we're doing it, and it's pretty exciting.
Well, we're out of time, unfortunately, but there's a whole lot more covered in the book, Regeneration, written by my guest, and a lot of contributors that help, including everyone from Jane Goodall to a lot of other people working to change our carbon trends. Paul Hawken is my guest. And where can people learn more about regeneration as it's going on? You mentioned a website earlier.
Yeah, regeneration.org is where they can go. And when they go to Nexus, eventually there's other things called climate action systems. But right now they go to Nexus and they choose a solution or a challenge or whatever. They will see links to hundreds and hundreds of people, resources, organizations that they may not know about.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much, Rich.
Paul Hawken is an environmentalist and author, the co-founder and former executive director of Project Drawdown, an organization that works to mitigate and reverse climate change. His latest book is titled Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. It's published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.